Jill Soloway wraps up the groundbreaking series Transparent without its original lead actor in a finale that's unlike any you've seen.
People will say, oh, you killed off Maura or you killed off Jeffrey Tambor. I really hate that way of talking about it. So we had to redo it on our own terms. We had to reclaim the space that was our show.
Then Robbie Robertson just collaborated with Martin Scorsese on The Irishman and released a new album. But he's also looking back 50 years to his time with the band, who were not always clean and sober.
If all five members weren't on point, it just didn't work.
And the story behind the surprisingly political messages inside Janet Jackson's 1989 dance album, Rhythm Nation. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. And on this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is impacted by the wider world. And we're going to begin today with an ending, and that is the last episode of the Amazon series Transparent. Created by Jill Soloway, the show premiered in the fall of 2014, before The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, before Fleabag. That's back when Amazon was still mostly known for selling boxes of stuff, not for winning Emmys. Before Transparent arrived, stories about trans people were largely untold on TV. The show was lauded, but also criticized for casting Jeffrey Tambor, a cisgendered man, to play the parent who transitions instead of a trans actor. Soloway once defended the choice by saying that the part was written based on the true story of Soloway's parent who transitioned. In 2015, Soloway won an Emmy for Outstanding Directing in a Comedy.
Thank you to the trans community for your lived lives. We need to stop violence against transgender women and topple the patriarchy. Topple the patriarchy!
But 2 years later, when the fourth season dropped, Tambor was accused of sexual harassment by two trans women on the show. The series went on hiatus, an investigation followed, and Tambor was fired. In the finale, the Tambor character Maura dies off-screen within the first few minutes, and the rest of the show is a celebration, complete with a funeral and a whole lot of song and dance.
And how long are we going to talk for, John?
I don't know, 20 minutes?
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say. Soloway joined us in studio the day before the finale dropped. So there's a moment in time where it becomes obvious the show is going to end, or probably should end, I guess. I don't know if there's a debate about how you might continue. You make a choice to end in a very specific and unusual way, which is with a musical of movie, I think we can call it, not an episode, but let's just call it a film. Your sister, Faith, is an executive producer on the show, and she wrote the songs. I'm going to start with the first one in the finale or finale?
Finale or finale.
Finale.
Or
this,
finale.
This one is called Sepulveda Boulevard.
It's close to a thing, and I think it's about to come true. Picking up the kids, the dry cleaning, and I'm heading to you.
What is it about music that you can do as a storyteller that you can't say in dialogue?
You know, it just gave us a new language. It gave us a new playground. And I love that we didn't just take songs and throw them at the movie, but instead Faith wrote them. And because Faith is my sibling, we grew up in the same family. We have the same sorts of boundary issues, the same feeling of, why do I feel so unseen when all I'm ever doing is trying to express myself? So that idea of even, you know, how can I be home and feel so alone? I'm always just 5 miles away. It's, I don't know, I just start rocking out to it when I hear it because I'm so enamored of Faith's gift.
I want to ask you about the family that you created on screen. You and your sister Faith had done a stage show about the Bradys not that long ago. And I'm curious, and there's a reference to the Brady Bunch, a fleeting reference in this episode. What kind of influence did they have on you as a TV creator?
They had a huge influence on us. Faith and I were obsessed with the Brady Bunch. We would fall asleep every night playing a game where one person would say a line from an episode and the other one had to guess which episode it was from. We were sort of like self, you know, taught Brady Bunch experts. And we loved it, I think, because of the way in which Mike and Carol held space for this hodgepodge, this family of other, you know, this kind of chosen family in many ways.
Mike, Cindy told Mrs. Engstrom she sprained her ankle. She dropped out of the play.
Well, no wonder she couldn't eat and she went right to her room.
Oh, Mike, she was so thrilled about doing that play.
Relax, honey. I'm going to straighten out things right now.
You know, Faith and I did a play called The Real Live Brady Bunch where, you know, pre-internet, I would sit a cassette recorder in front of the television, record the episode, put on headphones, transcribe it, and we would then work with actors to actually mount the Brady Bunch episode as important theater. And that was kind of our first big success as sisters. It went all around the country and also all around the world on tour. And then, yeah, in the transparent musicale finale, Ari Pfefferman, formerly known as Allie, goes into this kind of hole where they're really encountering that they are a show. You know, that is just this rabbit hole of this thing of like, well, wait, my family, I'm on a show that stars my family. And it kind of loops in and goes and gets the Brady Bunch as part of this fantasy. So, yeah, it kind of comes back for those who know.
We're talking with Jill Soloway, the creator of Transparent, which is ending with a big musical finale.
Oh, my children, this part of me was so forbidden. I'm reaching for you from
how much did you try to practice what you preached and cast, as the show evolved, more trans actors to hire women or trans directors and writers, and to really make sure that everybody who was working on the show was comfortable being who they felt they were born to be?
Yeah, well, we kind of ended up sort of doing an upside down world, like a world that felt a little bit gender reversed, where it was more normal to be trans than cis in the world of Transparent, that if you came to work at Transparent, you would find everybody wearing a name tag that had their pronouns on it. You would find pronouns on call sheets. You would find bathrooms where everybody was comfortable to go anywhere. I think there was a moment that I really kind of got it where, oh, Jeffrey Tambor playing a trans woman is dangerous in a way for trans women. You know, so representation, when people say, you know, this character was written as Asian, and an Asian person needs to play this character. Like, absolutely, representation is totally important for that reason. But in the case of trans women, they were being thought of as men dressing up as women. And so it was such a dangerous precedent to have somebody that people knew as a man, Jeffrey Tambor, playing this character. At the same time, that's what made a lot of people watch. In fact, I read like an article from somebody who's trans, and she said, she watched it, you know, because she knew Jeffrey from Arrested Development. So there was something about his familiarity and, of course, his brilliance and his acting that was right at the time for Mora. But once we all kind of had our education and unfortunately had to have that education in public, you know, it was like, what can we do? We can just provide as many opportunities for trans people as possible.
This is a difficult hypothetical, but had you not made this show, do you think you would see yourself the way you see yourself today? Did it help you evolve in terms of understanding your identity?
Well, I definitely was around so many non-binary people that I started to go, oh, that really seems like a comfortable, relaxing place to be. It was more about letting go of the ways in which I indulged in self-hatred for not being a certain kind of woman, not being pretty enough, or trying to kind of shape my power so that I felt cute instead, you know, just trying to not overwhelm people. And as soon as I took gender off of these ideas of myself, I just felt so much more comfortable. Like, okay, I have no gender anymore. I can be both genders. I can constantly switch. Meeting people who were non-binary, you know, definitely made me want to be more like them. But I just think, like, sometimes those time machine questions are so hard to answer because people say, like, would you have cast Jeffrey Tambor? And I just think, you know, I wish there were time machines, but there aren't time machines. So I find the time machine questions really, really hard to answer.
What was the process, A, about deciding to end, and B, how to end? And did they overlap?
Well, one of the things that is pretty common in television these days that you'll hear from a lot of showrunners is that networks or streaming places like Netflix or Amazon or anyone don't actually want shows to go 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 seasons anymore. A lot of people are finding out that their streaming homes and networks are really happy with 3 seasons or 4 seasons, because the idea when you're trying to get somebody to sign up for Netflix or for Amazon is new people who've never been there before. So you need a new show. So there isn't that same thing, which is like, how long can we go? We want to go 15 seasons. And so when everything happened with Jeffrey, that kind of started to, I think, begin the conversation of maybe it's time to end. And because in some ways...
On whose part? On their part or your part?
It was kind of a little vibe from everybody.
Okay.
It was sort of a collective consciousness of, is there a reason to keep going when we don't have our main character? And yet at the same time, I didn't really want it to end on those terms, which are, you know, actor charged with sexual harassment, show dies, falls away. I couldn't have that be the ending of this thing that felt so much more celebratory. And in fact, I think even though some people will say, oh, you killed off Maura or you killed off Jeffrey Tambor, I really hate that way of talking about it, because Maura herself is a really important trans woman. And because so many trans women's lives are devalued and so many trans women are at risk of murder just from walking down the street, we couldn't let that be the end. So we had to redo it on our own terms. We had to reclaim the space that was our show and really just reframe what we were doing there. And in doing so, we came up with this idea of taking this huge risk and using my sister's musical talent. And that's the Transparent Musicale Finale, or you could call it the Musicale Finale. It's up to you.
So Transparent is gone, but 2 years ago, there was a showcase, Faith Soloway and Friends Should Transparent Become a Musical? Is there an answer?
Yeah, well, hopefully soon we'll be able to put the word out, but we are heading into a theatrical exploration, and we like to say Transparent isn't ending, it's transitioning into a musical.
Perfect. Jill Soloway, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. This is such a special way to spend my birthday.
Oh,
I really
appreciate
the walk down memory.
Jill Soloway is the creator of Transparent. The entire show, including its musical finale, can be found on Amazon. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. 3 decades ago, Janet Jackson released Rhythm Nation 1814.
The homeless problem.
The bullets.
Violent crimes are on the uprise.
It was a follow-up to Control, her platinum-selling album from 3 years before. That earlier album focused on themes of personal self-empowerment, but Rhythm Nation was much more about the mood of the country. Lindsay Zoladz is a staff writer at The Ringer, and she wrote about the 30th anniversary of Rhythm Nation and how it laid the groundwork for the socially conscious pop music of today. Hey, Lindsay.
Hi.
So what were some of the key events that were going on in the world that set the tone for Rhythm Nation when Janet Jackson recorded it?
So this was the tail end of the Reagan era. There was a lot of focus on homelessness, illiteracy, crime, drugs, the crack epidemic. All these things were in the news. And it was also, interestingly enough, the beginning of sort of the 24-hour news cycle. CNN had recently launched. So it's a time that feels sort of akin to how we often feel today about the events going on in the world, and just that there is always something happening and it's very dramatic and all these social problems sort of build on one another. And I think that feeling and the way that mass media was transmitting that feeling really influenced the sound and also the focus of this record.
There's some sort of pledge, I think you could call it, at the beginning of the album, and it goes like this. We are a nation with no geographic boundaries.
Bound together through our beliefs. We are like-minded individuals sharing a common vision, pushing toward a world rid of color lines.
How much of that philosophy was reflected in the individual songs?
Yeah, the sequencing of this record is really interesting to me, and it was very intentional on Janet and her producer's part in that it's sort of front-loaded with these almost message songs, you could call them. There's a song called State of the World.
On the street. People can't find enough to eat.
There's a song called The Knowledge that is about empowering yourself with education and literacy. And then, of course, the title track, Rhythm Nation, which comes after that pledge you mentioned. But it's interesting that those are the first three proper songs, and then there's this interlude where she says, get the point.
Good. Let's dance.
And then the dance songs come in. So there is this kind of stark divide on the record between these are the message songs, but then there's also the fun dance songs like Escapade and Love Will Never Do Without You that make this record a little more complicated than just a social mission statement. First two records she put out kind of sound like Michael Jackson off the wall B-sides. They really don't have the sonic personality we've come to associate specifically with Janet Jackson. And I think that to develop that particular sound that's just very almost militant, really hard driving, crystalline synths, and that really hard edged percussion that almost comes from a hip hop point of view, she had to break away from her family's influence a little bit and work with these outside producers to differentiate herself as a Jackson. And I believe it was Jimmy Jam who very rightfully pointed out in one of the interviews I quote in the piece that there's something rhythmic and almost rapper-like about some of Janet's cadences on these songs. You know, she really had a good sense of her voice as a percussion instrument. You know, women were sort of expected to be soft and crooning in this more seductive way at the time in pop music, and not sounding quite as hard as she does at times on this record.
We're talking with Lindsay Zoladz at The Ringer about Janet Jackson. She had not been terribly political before Rhythm Nation. How was it received at the time, and how did she respond to any pushback from critics?
There was a sense, you know, because this record was a huge success and there was a lot of publicity behind it. It was a real blockbuster at the time. And as with anything that big, there was, you know, there were skeptics and there was some cynicism of just, oh, does she think she's going to change the world with these pop songs? And she, in a Rolling Stone interview around a little bit after the record came out, she kind of addressed that and was like, look, I'm not expecting this music to change the world, but I do want to bring more of a consciousness to pop music. She said, my audience is different and a little younger and maybe not as aware of what's going on in the world. So to start from this basic element of telling people to educate themselves, I think at the time for pop music, radio pop music, that was pretty radical.
How would you say her work influenced contemporary artists like Beyoncé or Childish Gambino, especially in terms of incorporating political themes into pop hits?
Yeah, I hear Janet Jackson and particularly this era of Janet Jackson all over the place in modern pop music. I think obviously Beyoncé and her aesthetic, her choreography, her emphasis on the visuals that I think you think of with the Rhythm Nation album. But I think even someone like Lizzo, just the really conversational sort of sassy nature of her music, I hear Janet in that. Even in someone like Ariana Grande, who is really kind of in conversation with the headlines in the pop world, because there's plenty of that in Janet's music too. It's not all the state of the world, but playing around with sort of the tabloid image of herself, which I think is something she did more on control than this record. But that was really pioneering for her. And, you know, I think almost any female pop artist of the last 30 years owes something to her and to these records.
Lindsay Zoladz is a writer at The Ringer. Her article is called Rhythm Nation at 30, How Janet Jackson Pioneered Dance Pop with a Purpose. Lindsay, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how Robbie Robertson talks with Martin Scorsese about the songs that he writes for the director's movies.
The most interesting thing that he says to me in most cases on most of the films, whatever you're doing, as long as it doesn't sound like movie music.
You're listening to The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Robbie Robertson has a studio in a private section of the renowned Village Studios in West LA. And on its walls hang more than a dozen guitars, including a pretty scuffed up acoustic that Robertson used to write the song that you're hearing now. It's called The Weight, and it's by the band.
Take the load off.
At 76 years old, Robertson has never been busier. He is the subject of a documentary called Once We're Brothers. He wrote music for Martin Scorsese's upcoming movie, The Irishman, and he recorded a new album.
I think they're all the same, as a matter of fact. And that's why my new record is called Cinematic, with an S, mind you.
I'm going to play a bit of the song Dead End Kid.
They said you'll never be nothing. You're just a dead-end kid. Probably end up in prison, or maybe down on the skids. No, you'll never be nothing. You're just a dead-end kid.
When you think about a song like that, how close is that to your own life and about the idea that you could have become a dead-end kid?
When I was growing up and I was going between the city, Toronto, and the Six Nation Indian Reserve, where my mom was from, a lot of times I couldn't help myself of talk about dreams and ambitions and things I want. And I was saying, I'm going to go out in the world, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to go there, and I'm going to make music, and I'm going to write stuff, and I was going to do all this stuff. And they were like, you're tripping, kid, you know, and you're going to be lucky if you don't end up in jail. And I was like, what do you mean? So part of that was in Indian country, it was like, you're going to be disappointed because people around here have real limitations. And when you grow up, you're going to find out about that. And in the city, being surrounded so much with this possibility of gangster life, you know, all of these things entering into it. And even when I joined Ronnie Hawkins one day said to me, if I hadn't hired you, you would have probably ended up in prison. And I was like, what do you mean? He said, no, I saw some things.
Do you think there might have been a grain of truth in that, though?
There was possibilities in that you could have just taken a left at the wrong point and anything could have happened.
I want to play another song from the record. This one is called Beautiful Madness.
Oh, it looks like I'm in too deep and I can't sleep. Now maybe it's depression, maybe it's a dope. This song, it's a little bit of both. It's such a beautiful madness.
This is a song that deals with drug addiction, and in your documentary, drug addiction is a huge part of the story of the band, about what happened to Rick Danko, Levon Helm, Richard Manuel, about them becoming addicts. And I'm thinking about that song, about what addiction meant to you and to witness it and what it did to your friends. How do you go about taking something that is that personal and make a song about addiction?
Back then, marijuana was considered the same as heroin. And so because of that, a lot of people thought, so what's the difference? Let's try this, let's try that. And what we didn't know was in people's nature, in people's, a certain chip in their brain, some people can try it and say, oh, I liked it or I didn't like it or I don't want to do it or, you know. And other people, it pushes a button. And that's called addiction. And we knew nothing about it. We knew nothing about alcoholism. But in this group, there was something about that addiction that really got in the way of our brotherhood and really got in the way of this was a band that if all five members weren't on point, it just didn't work the same. And trying to lift up one side of it that was bent over and everything was a big job and a hard job and a heartbreaking job too.
We're talking with Robbie Robertson about his new album and his new movie. When you guys made Big Pink with a band, it was a novel idea to actually leave the city, hole up someplace, and make music there. And I'm wondering if you've retained any of that, to isolate yourself from outside noise and figure out where you do your best creative work. We're in your studio now. Is it here? Is it somewhere else? How do you insulate yourself in a way that seemed to work so well on that album?
That was a dream of mine, to have a sanctuary, because I found when we would go from the basement of Big Pink, where we made the basement tapes, and then we would go into a recording studio, we were in somebody else's house. There was a big clock on the wall. There was guys there that said, well, you know, my shift is going to be up in an hour, so we better get this done. And I didn't think that we could do our best work on that circumstance. So the next record we made, the band, we got a house in the Hollywood Hills, Sammy Davis Jr.'s house, and recorded an album in the pool house there. The record company thought I was out of my mind, but I knew something about these guys. I knew that if we had our true unique surroundings, that we could go to a place, and when we came out of that place, we had made music unlike anybody else in the world. And now I'm putting together the 50th anniversary of that extraordinary experience.
That isn't the only thing that happened 50 years ago. You guys played a little concert at Woodstock. And people who've seen the Woodstock concert movie probably don't know the band played at Woodstock. How come you guys didn't make the cut of that movie? And are you on the multi, like 30 some odd CD set that just came out?
When we went and played, it was at 9 o'clock, the last night of the festival. It was the height of the festival. There was 500,000 people in the audience. And when we got there, you could see that everybody was out there. They wanted to rock. They wanted to rip off their shirts. They wanted to roll in the mud. They wanted to get crazy. And when we went and played, it was like somebody coming and doing hymns. It was more of a spiritual. So you saw this go out over the crowd and everybody completely go to a different zone.
Say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not.
But we hadn't played hardly any concerts as the band. So then there was cameramen running around the stage and sticking a camera up in your face while you're doing it. But our manager, Albert Grossman, said, no cameras on the stage. We are not going to have that. This is a different kind of thing. And so Martin Scorsese, who was the assistant director on the film and was working on it, he was like, oh no, we got to shoot it from way back here.
You've worked with Marty a lot. How would you describe your creative partnership with a filmmaker like Martin Scorsese?
You know, it's always different on the movies that I've worked on with him. I mean, starting back with Raging Bull, every time it's a different challenge. Most of the times I read a version of the script, and then when they have usually a rough cut of it. I'll see what it is. And during the process, there's many times that we bounce ideas back and forth. And the most interesting thing that he says to me, in most cases, on most of the films, whatever you're doing, as long as it doesn't sound like movie music. And so that eliminates a lot.
Robbie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
Robbie Robertson's album, Cinematic, is out now. The Irishman arrives on Netflix and in theaters later this year. And it's not always easy for a composer and a director to get along. So every year, a group of tomorrow's John Williams and Hans Zimmers, or even Robbie Robertson's, head up to Skywalker Ranch in Northern California. They're there for a lab that pairs the film composers with indie film directors for 2 weeks of concentrated collaboration. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving drove upstate for the last day of camp, and he sent us this report.
Skywalker Ranch, named for Luke Skywalker since it was built by his creative daddy, George Lucas, is a pastoral paradise just north of San Francisco. It's a state-of-the-art post-production facility where most major Hollywood movies get their final sound mixes.
This is the outgrowth of a frustrated architect that ends up with more money than he needs.
Is this a boy's idea of paradise?
In a way, it is. I need a rural environment in which to work. I get my best ideas being able to walk around and enjoy myself.
And for the past 7 years, it's a campground for the Sundance Institute Film Music and Sound Design Lab. The lab itself started more than 20 years ago when BMI, the performing rights organization with a clientele of famous film composers, teamed up with Robert Redford's Indie Incubator.
Redford and his people were starting this incredible film institute that was all about developing original voices and working to support, with a very inclusive agenda, all kinds of developing artists.
Doreen Ringer Ross is the vice president of film and media music at BMI.
Our platform became very akin to theirs, except it was all about music.
Alumni of the lab include Riverdale composer Sherry Chung and Green Book composer Chris Bowers. This year, 8 composers were selected out of more than 700 applicants from all around the world. These are composers with some scores under their belts, with a career already on the runway, who see it as a chance to really take off.
I've actually always been an artist on just, you know, making my own music.
Asuka Matsumiya is a composer from Japan.
I got into film score music because one of my songs that I wrote was used as a theme song for a short film called I'm Here by Spike Jonze.
When I turn away.
Matsumiya was one of 5 women composer fellows this year. One of the lab's most obvious contributions is shaking up an overwhelmingly male field. Doreen Ringer Ross says that's intentional.
We tried to find as many women each time that were equally, you know, qualified that we could include. And over time, if you do some kind of affirmative action, you know, you can start to make a difference.
At the lab, each composer gets paired with a director who brings in a nearly finished indie film. Gia Rushidat, another fellow this year, hails from Jordan.
Actually living in the same space for like a week, if we have wine at night, we just like talk about the film. And if we wake up like at breakfast and have coffee, we talk about the film. And it's so much fun. I wish I could like live with my director for like 2 weeks or something before we start scoring.
One of the major takeaways here is teaching composers and directors who have one of the more unique collaborative tangos in filmmaking how to communicate. The director fellows had several industry pros drop in as creative advisors, including American Psycho director Mary Harron and Danish editor Jacob Schulsinger, whose credits include Force Majeure and Big Little Lies.
Most of the world, probably, but also especially the film business, is running really short on time and has the danger of working with fear, which is not good for creativity. So to create a place where directors can come with their movie and explore in a safe environment what sound and music can do to make their movie better is really unique, I think.
Composer fellows had drop-ins from several A-list advisors, including James Newton Howard and Marco Beltrami. That made all the difference for Ozzie Cargyle from Detroit.
They're sharing stories about how they met their directors, how they survived, you know, a crisis of a production. And this really sort of open, transparent sharing of their experiences that, for lack of a better word, humanizes this highly celebrated art form and makes you feel like, okay, if they had their struggles and their challenges, but they made it to where they are, I can do the same thing.
Over the 2 weeks, each composer scored one scene from the film of their paired director. On the last day, a chamber orchestra recorded the music on Skywalker's scoring stage. This is Ozzy Cargyle's score for The Hunt, a documentary about truffle hunters and their dogs. Cargyle says an unexpected bonus of the lab was meeting an alumnus who now works as its technical director.
Jean-Luc Bontemps. I was a black composer. Meeting him and really getting a chance to speak with him gave me an even greater dimension in terms of how this journey works for black composers, because there aren't a lot of black composers in Hollywood. Hearing his story, too, as a black composer and coming into the industry and succeeding as he has was also very personal inspiration to me.
Start looking for Cargyle's name in the end credits. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
Coming up, the story in the Netflix series Unbelievable was already a Pulitzer Prize-winning article, an episode of This American Life, and a book. Its creators think there was still more to say.
So this story had been told really well in three forms, but it seemed like sometimes you can get into someone's heart in our form of narrative storytelling a little bit more penetratingly.
Making Unbelievable, that's next on The Frame Weekend. This is The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. The Netflix series Unbelievable follows the true story of an 18-year-old in Washington State who was charged with lying about being raped, and the two detectives working a different case in Colorado who eventually found the serial rapist who had, in fact, attacked the woman in Washington, among many others. The detectives are played by Merritt Weaver and Toni Collette.
We're going to merge our investigations today, right now. You're going to move over to my joint. It's no offense, but we've got better toys. We're going to bring in the FBI. We're going to bring in the CBI. We're going to exploit every resource available to us, and we are going to find that sick mother. We're going to find him and arrest him, and we're going to put him away before he has a chance to hurt someone else, which, you know, he is out there planning to do.
Sarah Timmerman is executive producer of Unbelievable. Susanna Grant, who got an Oscar nomination for writing Erin Brockovich, is the series showrunner. All 8 episodes of Unbelievable dropped on Netflix a week ago. Before we talk about the show, I want to ask you about the reactions that you have heard about the show and what have been the most meaningful. It's hard to say rewarding because it feels a little awkward talking about getting rewards for something about a show that is so difficult and is addressing such an important topic. But what has gratified you most about what you're hearing from people?
Well, we've gotten a lot of really strong responses, but I'd say without a doubt, the most affecting response has been the one that The Real Marie shared with Ken Armstrong, who's the journalist who reported her side of the original story that we used as the basis for the series. And she allowed him to share that publicly. And that really, above all the others, was the most meaningful to me, to hear that she felt that we had treated her story with respect and told the truth of her experience and that she got some closure from it. That wasn't why we did it. And it was important to tell the story, not being beholden to her exclusively. But hearing that the way we told the story was healing for her was very gratifying.
And that nothing mattered compared to that for any of us, really. I mean, it's nice that the show has received, some strong responses, but hers was, once we heard that, it felt like anything else was, gravy. I will add that one of the reviews recently said that it's one of the most humane shows on television, and I personally thought that was gratifying. I personally felt it reflected Susanna's work as a storyteller over the course of her entire career. So,
and Susanna, you had made a movie about Anita Hill. So
right.
You have been around stories about women who claim they were harassed or assaulted and they weren't believed.
Yeah. And, you know, when that one came out, everyone said, God, can you believe how timely this is? But, it, you know, this is always timely. Yes, there are stories very top of mind right now about gender-based imbalance of power and gender-based violence and abuse of power along gender lines. But let me tell you, those stories are always present. This is something we are living with every day. So it feels relevant now. It's always relevant.
You may have read there was a great piece in The Atlantic in, I think, July about untested rape kits around the country. And what the journalist arrived at was the conclusion that we can do so much more. And it's a question of will. You know, it's a question of interest in pursuing
right. yeah,
sexual assault
caring.
As an important
right.
caring about sexual
yeah,
assault.
Yeah, which was a reason to tell this story. This story had been told really well in three forms, but it seemed like the value in doing it this way was exactly that. You know, there's sometimes you can get into someone's heart in, you know, in our form of narrative storytelling a little bit more penetratingly. Certainly when you have the caliber of actors we were working with, it's very hard not to care about this issue.
And the opportunity to just amplify the story right. in 190 countries where Netflix, you know, finds itself was exciting for us because people are paying attention. It's been great to see a response in other countries.
We're talking with Susanna Grant and Sarah Timmerman about the series Unbelievable. The other thing that is clearly very intentional on your part is to show two women who are incredibly competent.
Yeah.
This is Grace Rasmussen, played by Toni Collette, and Detective Karen Duvall, played by Merritt Weaver.
It's all right with you. I'd like to ask you some questions.
Sure.
It's a little busy out here. Would you be comfortable talking in my car?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, good. That's me right here.
Minor spoiler, they're not quite getting along for the beginning of their collaboration, and then they decide they're going to work together. And in some ways, you know, they are superheroes because they do everything they can do at the sacrifice of their personal lives and their family to track this guy down.
Yeah, they are really competent, and they're really driven, and they're really dedicated. But they're fallible, and they make mistakes, and they have weaknesses,
and they get short-tempered.
I
didn't say they're perfect. I said they're really good at their jobs.
They are very good at their jobs. Yeah, but it seemed like a great opportunity to watch one of those partnerships that just felt real. Just felt like real people,
and it didn't require a lot of embellishment, because those two real women did that work. There are composites of some people involved with them, but that's what they did, which is, of course, the hopeful other side of the story when you're watching these two narratives. And one is sort of a downward spiral, and one is this push, this dynamic push forward. That's what they did, which is what was so striking about the source material. It's, you know, it's inspiring.
Susanna Grant is the creator, executive producer, and co-director of Unbelievable. Sarah Timmerman is the series executive producer. Sarah and Susanna, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Unbelievable is now streaming on Netflix. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame Weekend. We're going to close today with the acclaimed singer and banjo player Rhiannon Giddens. She's among the featured artists in Ken Burns' epic 8-episode, 16-hour documentary series about country music.
My hat's off to Ken for inviting me in. You know, I do speak my mind. but it was a really great experience, and I just said, you know, look, I can offer up a perspective that is not, you know, the one that you might assume when you think about country music.
Brown baby, brown baby.
It's important to be in the room because then you get to say things and you get to say, well, have you considered this? And this is a different point of view. And I said a few things that I think are important to be said.
We like to talk about the founding fathers a lot, but the people who built this country, that's the people where country and blues come from. you know, are those people, and you don't have America without them.
I said a few things that I'm not the only one who said them. I just think that somebody needs to be in there to say them, and if that's me, then I will represent, you know, the movement of trying to uncover the, you know, the true history.
The banjo, second only to the fiddle early on, came to America as a gourd with a fretless neck brought by slaves from Africa.
It is the only and first, you know, truly American instrument, you know, brought over by Africans who were enslaved and brought over to the New World, and they brought these proto-banjos with them, and it became the banjo in the New World, you know, in the Caribbean, and then carried up into North America and the United States, and white entertainers picked it up, and, you know, it sort of started to get modified a little bit here and there and kind of go back and forth between the black and white cultures. And then eventually the fiddle and banjo music becomes the core of a pan-southern string tradition that also goes up into the north and out into the west. That is the foundation for much of American music. I'm obviously drawn to the women of country music because that's who I usually cover and you know, and really enjoy listening to so much. And I love Cousin Emmy, who was banjo. She played banjo and fiddle, and she sang and she played the rubber glove. I mean, she was amazing.
Do Johnny Booker, oh, do, 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 Johnny Booker, oh, do. I asked Johnny Booker for a cook of salt to give me half a bushel of his old mean jaw, do. Johnny Booker, oh, do, 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 Johnny Booker, oh, do.
But I had some recordings of her, and I just loved the way that she played the banjo. And that Ruby, she wrote Ruby, Are You Mad at Your Man, and that's one that's known as a bluegrass song, but she wrote it on clawhammer banjo, which is that older style, the mountain style, or the African style, actually, we find out.
Ruby, honey, are you mad at your man? I don't like to do to drag it along with you.
So I've played that song, and it's, you know, it harkens back to where the Grand Ole Opry in particular started, which was his barn dance. It really pulled from all of those old string band tunes.
Are you mad at your man? I'll shovel in the
That's a song that I've loved for a long time, and I love finding the version that people don't do of a song that's really popular in another genre. That also really speaks to me. So I loved going back to the original feel of that song and the woman singing it, you know. And then, you know, I'm kind of known for taking a Patsy Cline song, She's Got You, and my first record with T-Bone Burnett, Tomorrow's My Turn, we did She's Got You. And I've often said, I'm on the record as saying that I think it's one of the most perfect songs ever written. I mean, it's just, there's no fat to that song. It says exactly what it needs to say in exactly the amount of words that it needs to say it in.
I've got your picture that you gave to me, and it's signed with love, just like it used to be.
That's an era of songwriting. I mean, Hank Cochran wrote that. He wrote a bunch of really amazing stuff. That's an era of writing that I admire because, you know, they're real simple, but not, you know, when you really get into the song, it's very hard to write a song like that.
She's got you. I've got the record. Oh.
Black women, for some reason, are not seen as viable candidates for any kind of career in country music, even though there have been people who have tried and who are very talented. You know, people have come in and made great music and have been completely ignored. You know, we've been way more together for way longer than you think. And especially the working class, people who are often the ones who are completely shafted when these narratives are made up, you know, about nationalism and this and that. It's disenfranchising the working class, and the working class is where all this cultural stuff happened, you know, is there. It's not with the people with all the money and bringing in like classical singers. It was on the ground. This is where this stuff was happening, you know, and this is where the bones of American culture were created.
That was musician Rhiannon Giddens. Her latest album is titled There Is No Other, and you can stream Ken Burns' series Country Music on PBS.org. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Robert Garova, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Itzi Quintanilla. Valentina Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff. The Frame's opening theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. And I'm John Horn from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here for the daily version of The Frame on Monday. I tried my best to love you. Now I'm